Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the reversal of President Obama's pledge not to put boots on the ground in Syria and assess the resilience of the Islamic State, who, despite Russian and American bombing, have captured strategic towns in Homs province and are poised to capture the main road that links Damascus with the northern cities. Hassan Hassan, the co-author of the New York Times bestseller ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror, who is an associate fellow at Chatham House in London and a non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy in Washington, D.C., joins us to discuss the deepening proxy war that will extend the agony in Syria. Then we'll analyze the Turkish elections, with early returns indicating President Erdogan's ruling AKP party is close to a majority, while the pro-Kurdish HDP and nationalist MHP parties appear likely to cross the 10% threshold to claim seats in parliament. An expert on Turkey, Asla Bali, a professor in the UCLA School of Law who specializes in international human rights and laws of war, and is the author of the forthcoming book, Constitutional Design in Religiously Divided Societies, joins us to discuss the role of Turkey's intelligence service, the MIT, in the recent bombings that appear to be a deliberate strategy of Erdogan's to polarize the country ahead of today's elections. Then finally, we examine the role of the Kurds in fighting the Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria, where they appear to be the only allies the U.S. has in the region, as the Obama administration continues its delusional policy of working with the corrupt government in Baghdad, which is allied with Russia and Iran, and Turkey's cynical President Erdogan, who appears to be working against U.S. objectives by bombing the Kurds, who we've just sent in American boots on the ground to fight with. David Phillips, a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the State Department during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama, and the author of Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East, joins us to discuss the strategic incoherence of our Iraq-Syria policy. And joining us now from London is Hassan Hassan, who's an associate fellow at Chatham House Middle East and North Africa Program and a non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy and the co-author of the New York Times bestseller ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hassan Hassan.
Thank you for having me.
And what's your understanding of why the Islamic State, or Daesh, as people in the region prefer to call it, why are they so resilient, given that both the U.S. and its coalition that the president tells us 60 nations are involved, and Russia are bombing them, yet they've managed to capture a couple of strategic towns in Homs province and moving to capture the highway that links Damascus with the northern cities?
Well, the simple answer is that ISIS, perhaps more than any force and country involved in the conflict, both in Iraq and Syria, has strategic patience that enables it to move when there's an opportunity. And I think we've seen evidence, or recent evidence, when the Russians started bombing in Syria, and they have taken areas in Aleppo, which is basically the center of the Russian airstrikes and the regime ground forces or ground offensive since the Russian intervention. ISIS moved in because there has been void left by the fact that the Russians were striking anti-ISIS rebel forces that are also fighting the regime. So that void was seized, that opportunity was seized by ISIS and moved very quickly to take some areas in northern Aleppo, in southern Aleppo, but also in Homs, just like you mentioned. They've been taking really important areas that they couldn't, take for a long time. For example, the areas they've taken in Aleppo, in the north, they have been trying to take them since early 2014, more than a year ago, and they couldn't. Now the airstrikes have left a void that ISIS filled. So that shows that ISIS has strategic patience and foresight. And it's planning very, very carefully. It knows what to do. and what to do next. It's instead of exposing itself to airstrikes, American airstrikes, Russian airstrikes, it's moving to vulnerable areas and areas that they know the Americans are not going to focus 24/7 on them. And they're making these steady gains. And that's really just a recent example of the ability of ISIS to really think ahead and outsmart everyone around them.
Well, it's my understanding that the Russians are, and the U.S. has been complaining about this, that the Russians are mainly focusing on bombing the al-Nusra and other jihadist groups that aren't the Islamic State, that are the ones that are most threatening to the Alawite redoubt that's left both in Damascus and in Latakia, where the Russians have a base. And on the other side, of course, much is being made of the 50 boots on the ground that the President Obama has had to reverse himself on, having pledged not to put boots on the ground in Syria. Now they're sending in some special forces to work with the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds on the Syria-Turkey border. So is that a correct picture, that the Russians are basically trying to save Assad, particularly in Damascus and close to Latakia, and that the U.S. is working with the Kurds? And it looks as though in the middle, the Islamic State, even though the U.S. is bombing them and Russia occasionally bombs them, they seem to be pretty much free to roam.
Absolutely. That's correct. We have to emphasize that for Russia, it's a question of priority. It's not, some people say, they're playing a dirty game of leaving ISIS alone. The fact is, if ISIS operates in or around Assad heartlands, probably the Russians will bomb them. The fact is, though, is that the forces that pose the greatest threat to the Russians and to the regime are moderate groups, nationalist groups, but also jihadist groups like Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham, which operate in the north. And national forces are more like to the south. Russia obviously is here, especially at this juncture. They're trying to save the regime. They're trying to secure the regime's heartland in very important areas, just like you mentioned, in Latakia and Aleppo and Homs and Hama, all these central and western areas that the Assad regime cannot afford to withdraw from. So that leaves ISIS being a lesser priority for the Russians, and the Americans are still wrestling with, or grappling, let's say, with the new reality, the Russian intervention. They don't know what to do. They are jostling for space, and they're trying to figure out who are the allies on the ground. The Kurds are probably the last remaining trustworthy allies. At least for them. So that leaves a big space for ISIS to operate in, and that's why we've seen the advances. The Americans find the Kurds are they're the most convenient forces, and that actually tells you sending forces, ground forces to Syria is an indication of a failure rather than success, or that they started to think about something else. It only indicates the fact that the only remaining allies that the Americans could work with are the Kurds. But the Kurds, which is the Kurds operate in very limited areas, and they have really limited benefit for the Americans, because they operate in the north. East, and they operate in the east in some areas. Now, the Kurds, even if the Americans operate with them and they become more successful against ISIS, they cannot move to areas where they are perceived as expansionist and invaders. So that tells you about just you know, the increasingly complex reality, especially after the Russian intervention and after the Kurds have taken, you know, secured their areas. And once they start moving elsewhere, it becomes problematic for everyone. So, I think just the situation has become really complex for the anti-ISIS forces in general.
So given this confusion that you've just described to us, Hassan, would you then conclude that the agony of Syria, where half the population has been displaced, about 300,000 have been killed, the country is essentially being ruined, that this agony, now that it appears to be more and more of a proxy war, particularly with the US and Russia entering in on opposite sides, if you will, would that mean that the agony is going to be prolonged? Although there are, of course, last Thursday and Friday, there were meetings in Vienna where there were supposedly the Iranians and I think pretty much all the people with a stake in it had sent their foreign ministers, but no word came out of that. So, where do we stand in both terms of the possibility of a peace deal, or is it more likely that the agony will continue?
You know, just like you said, the stakes are higher now. Every party of the conflict and involved in the conflict is raising the stakes. And, you know, the talks that took place last week or over the weekend, they were, you know, I think they were, they missed. They were like in a fantasy world. They were not really in touch with the reality on the ground. They were talking about a secular country and about you know, they didn't mention Bashar Assad. So there was no mention of really what's happening on the ground. There were just dozens of countries sitting at a table and talking about something that is really distant about the conflict. In Syria. The fact is, on the ground, the situation is becoming much more complex. Like I said, and much more harder to resolve. The fact that the Russians are there, the fact that I think the fight against ISIS in both Iraq and Syria is now saturated, has reached a deadlock where if you know, the allies that you could work with, like the Kurds and the Shia, if they move to Sunni areas, then they start to create problems and tensions, which could benefit ISIS. And everyone's priority, whether, you know, the Gulf states, the Arab Gulf states, Iran, Russia, you know, the Assad regime and the United States, all of them have different priorities that have nothing to do or little to do with ISIS. The Gulf states are bogged down in Yemen. Iran and the Assad regime, along with the Russians, are busy shoring up the regime in areas outside ISIS areas. The Kurds have their own project. They also have their own tensions with Turkey. And, you know, the United States obviously is more worried about Jabhat al-Nusra. And, you know, they're trying to also preempt, any move by Jabhat al-Nusra to grow and entrench itself in Syria, which has policy implications because the focus on Jabhat al-Nusra and other forces that are fighting the Assad regime, even though they are a jihadist group, are creating problems for the United States policy in Syria because everyone on the opposition side views the American priority as priorities is closer to the Russians and the Assad regime's priorities. So, the conclusion is basically that I think the worst is coming. We haven't seen the worst yet. And I think the conflict is becoming more, complicated, deeper and harder to resolve. And it's becoming also more international because you have one superpower now more involved on the ground. It no longer can claim that it has a neutral stance on the conflict, or it can pressure the Assad regime like everyone has been hoping for a long time. So that's the grim reality that we're facing today.
So the alternatives of possible peace deal, I imagine the only way that that could ever be materialized would be some kind of territorial division or the balkanization of this already fractured country. And that seems pretty unworkable. And then on the other hand, everybody's all has been saying for the longest time that even if there's a resolution, either if ISIS wins or if and it's not likely, of course, that the Assads will win, they're you know, pretty much being driven back into the Alawite heartland. But the assumption's always been that even if this war ends with some kind of truce, another war will begin to eliminate the Islamic State, and that that would require, either way, whatever deal that you could possibly make would require the deployment of lots and lots of peacekeepers. Presumably, they'd have to come from Muslim countries, and that seems like a tall order to me.
Absolutely, and I think you touched on the problem. I think, especially in the way outsiders, foreign countries, back in whether the opposition or the Assad regime view the conflict and the end game for the Syrian conflict. I think the biggest problem is the disproportional focus on who rules Damascus and talking about, you know, what's the form of governance in the future and so on. And I think that misses the point. I think it's no longer about Bashar Assad. It's no longer about who governs Syria. It's about looking at the reality in different parts of the country. Just like you said, it's a deeply fractured country, even if it's not officially fractured. It is, and in order to start resolving the conflict, you need to start looking at the different parts of the country and start looking for different solutions and local maybe kind of ideas or local-driven ideas. So, for example, can you imagine the same solution for eastern Syria, which is controlled by ISIS, and some of it is controlled by the Kurds, to apply and work in Aleppo, or the solution in Aleppo can work in Daraa in the south of Syria? You know, it's impossible. So you need to really start looking at front level. And start thinking about how to deal with ISIS and how to deal with the fact that the barrel bombs that are falling on civilians in Aleppo, which is driving the refugees outside the country, and how do you deal with the threat of Damascus being attacked by jihadists and so on, or the minorities in Western Syria. These are all, you know, I think different problems that require different solutions. And I think the way to start doing that is basically, like I said, look at it differently, but also, identify the priorities. So in order to fight ISIS, you need to resolve the conflict. How do you resolve the conflict? You need to look at it, you need to start empowering the anti-Assad, forces, in order for them to say to force the Assad regime to accept ceasefires and accept peace deals on the ground. And we've seen evidence of that. It's not like a fantasy or a theory. It's not a theoretical issue. It has happened several times. Recently, a couple of months ago, the Assad regime or Iran, on behalf of the Assad regime, was forced to sign a deal with what's called Jesh al-Fatah, or the Army of Conquest, which is a coalition of jihadist and Islamist groups. They were forced to accept a deal with them that involved a no-fly zone, or a de facto no-fly zone, in some or over some towns in southern and northern Syria. That is a model that tells you one thing, which is basically when the Assad regime starts facing real threats, that's when it starts compromising, not when the Russians come and guarantee, or the Americans indeed guarantee it's a future. When they say the Assad regime will rule and it's a secular, you know, the future. For basically, the provisions of the deal last week was another way of saying nobody is now asking for the downfall of the regime, and the regime is comfortable. Russia is there to ensure it survives. So what's the incentive for the Assad regime to accept any compromise?
Well, Hassan Hassan, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Hassan Hassan, who is in London. He's an associate fellow at Chatham House's Middle East and North Africa program and a non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy and the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of the Turkish elections.
This is a war we can win. After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins? And I don't know.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was the coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and her forthcoming book is Constitutional Design in Religiously Divided Societies, with a chapter on Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asla Bali.
Thank you so much.
And the elections in Turkey, which are obviously quite critical since there's so much going on in the neighborhood, at this point, according to the BBC, Erdogan may have a majority with 80% votes counted. His party, the AKP, are at 50.8%. The main opposition, CHP, 23.8%. And the pro-Kurdish HDP and the nationalist MHP appear likely to cross the 10% threshold that they will need to claim seats in parliament. But already people are crying foul and suggesting that the only way Erdogan is going to get a majority is through electoral fraud. Is that your sense?
No, that isn't my sense. It's conceivable that that could be the case. At the moment, by the way, the count that I've most recently seen from the Turkish papers is that with about 90-plus percent of the votes counted, the AKP is just under 50%, something more on the order of 49.5%. And the CHP seems to have picked up to over 25%. And HDP and MHP are still looking likely to cross the 10% threshold, but they're very close, especially the HDP. It's conceivable that there's electoral fraud. I think the much more important story is that the way that Erdogan has increased his vote share by maybe as much as 10% from the election just 5 months ago is by driving the country to the brink of civil war and playing a kind of dirty ethnic politics, fear-mongering about Kurds, and specifically drawing votes away from, well, first HDP, and then also MHP. So the two parties that are barely able to cross the threshold right now are the ultra-nationalist party, which has lost some of its vote share to the AKP because the AKP appears to have now shifted so far to the right in a specifically ethno-nationalist way that the traditional constituency base of the MHP finds the AKP more appealing. And conversely, the HDP had managed to attract a number of votes from just liberal leftist people in Turkey who would ordinarily vote for the CHP, but the combination of a charismatic, young, and very progressive party leader of the HDP and the clear understanding amongst the Turkish electorate that the failure of the HDP to pass the electoral threshold has been yielding tremendous inflated electoral share for the AKP. The combination of those two things, excellent leadership at the HDP, combined with growing strategic analysis amongst the Turkish electorate about why the AKP keeps consolidating its position, led many CHP voters to vote for the HDP. Very sadly, the AKP strategy of driving ethnic conflict in Turkey has succeeded, it looks like, in causing those voters to return to the CHP and not to cast votes for the HDP, in part because they worry, I think, that the HDP is not as independent of the PKK as it claims, and they blame the PKK incredibly for the violence that the Turkish government, and specifically the AKP, has driven. So what's depressing about this election result is less the possibility that there's been electoral fraud, although, you know, that is possible. But the truth is, you know, Erdogan is able to successfully gain a tremendous vote share in Turkey by playing this kind of cynical game of driving the country to civil war in order to improve his own electoral prospects for the party.
So how far can you take that notion that he's cynical and divisive, which he clearly is? Is it possible that, as many people suspect, that the MIT, the National Intelligence Service of Turkey, is in any way involved in these bombings, particularly the one in Ankara that killed 100 members of the HDP who were staging a peace rally?
Well, there are two ways that the MIT can be involved. One is by acts of commission, and the other is by acts of omission. And the latter is without doubt the case. I mean, it's just impossible to explain how a major bombing takes place kilometers from the MIT headquarters at a very central part of Ankara against a demonstration that was projected to draw tens of thousands of people and yet had next to no security presence. I mean, again, one has to put this in context in Turkey, where a demonstration of dozens, you know, people, or, you know, at most 100 people, often draws a presence of security services and riot police that's double that of the number of protesters. And yet here you have, in the heart of the capital, a major demonstration involving tens of thousands of people, and very little to no security presence is detected by anyone, and a major bombing occurs. So to begin with, that's either an incredible failure, but that's hard to credit because Turkey has such a very clear protocol around its tolerance for large demonstrations and, you know, deploys massive security presence always. So one could say somehow it was overlooked. It's very implausible. Or there was a deliberate decision not to provide the kind of security that would have actually protected those demonstrators. That's the first problem. And the second question is, who are the characters that engaged in this bombing? You know, obviously the Turkish state and everyone else believes it to be Islamic State actors. And to what extent were these actors known? And again, the media had actually flagged in Turkey that at least one of the individuals that suspected having been involved in the bombing should have been in custody, should have been being monitored, and so on. So these were people that were well enough known that the Turkish media was able to speculate about whether or not they were being kept under tight enough sort of watch and guard, and yet there wasn't sufficient protection to prevent them from engaging in a major attack in the capital. All of that leads to the conclusion that, you know, there is definitely something going on by omission or commission that makes the government accountable for what happened in Ankara beyond the ways in which any government is accountable for providing for the basic security of their population. In addition, with such an incredibly large terrorist attack, the largest in the Republican history of the country, the fact that no heads have rolled, there's been no semblance of meaningful accountability at the higher echelons of those responsible for Ministry of Interior, the police, the MIT, as you say, the National Intelligence Service, is also telling. I mean, there has been no one held to account. And indeed, the context that we see since the June 7th election, in which the AKP for the first time lost a majority, and in which the Kurdish party, or pro-Kurdish party, HDP, for the first time exceeded the electoral threshold and gained seats at the AKP's expense, what we've seen since that time is Islamic State or other jihadist attacks against pro-Kurdish, Kurdish peace activists and demonstrators that the government has used as a pretext to attack Kurds. In other words, rather than attacking the perpetrators of these attacks, or rather than targeting the perpetrators of these attacks, the government has selected to go after their victims and then characterize this as somehow a national security measure. It is against this backdrop in which the government is piling on against Kurdish groups in Turkey that have already become vulnerable to attacks from the Islamic State that the cynical and cold, calculated strategy of the AKP to drive ethnic conflict is so depressing.
And again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was a coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and her forthcoming book is Constitutional Design in Religiously Divided Societies. And I might add that you're a new mother, and you have a boisterous child there. So is it possible then, I mean, I want to add that in terms of the bombing in Ankara, of course, the Islamic State has not claimed credit. They normally do, but that, of course, they're not to be necessarily believed. But is Erdogan worried if he doesn't get a majority that there'll be a parliamentary inquiry into the enormous corruption that he has unleashed, particularly within his own family? And, you know, he's going after Hurriyet News and, of course, the Gulenists. He's been going after them for the longest time. He seems to be paranoid and very proactive in trying to silence anybody that might be looking into the endemic corruption. I mean, he started out, the AKP started out as a fresh, you know, clean kind of optimistic government that had genuine accomplishments in their early years, but, you know, absolute power corrupts.
Indeed. Well, to start with, even if the AKP were to lose its majority, it would maintain clearly the largest single bloc in the parliament and would be able to block any such parliamentary inquiry into corruption as they have done now for well over 4 years since the first, you know, very significant allegations of corruption began to emerge. As you say, Erdogan pursues, I would say, less than paranoid, a deeply vindictive strategy. It's not paranoid to think that there would be an investigation because there's so much overwhelming evidence of corruption that any independent government would indeed, and any independent judiciary, any independent set of prosecutors would indeed investigate. And as a result, he has made it completely impossible for there to be independent prosecutors or judiciary. And one mechanism that he's used to clamp down on the judiciary and the prosecutors is to allege that they're involved in a giant conspiracy, as you say, with the Gulen movement, and to basically remove from their posts anyone who has shown the signs of sufficient independence that they might have a mind to actually look into investigating the AKP despite the climate of intimidation. And so that channel has been completely foreclosed. A parliamentary inquiry, given the AKP's vote share, with or without a majority, is foreclosed. And the AKP, in terms of media, has used an incredible strategy of intimidation, which doesn't, I mean, really, like, the most visible part, which is the part in which they go after with huge punitive tax fines, for example, against the Doğan Group, or engage in criminal charges of alleged terrorist activity against media aligned with the Fethullah Gulen ownership structures. That's the most visible part. But beyond that, and indeed I should add, they also have taken to the tactic of calling upon mobs to engage in lynch tactics and looting and attacks, physical attacks on editors, attacks on the offices of critical opposition media, et cetera. But beyond these strategies, there's also just the basic fact of media ownership consolidation in the hands of, AKP affiliates, including family members. And so basically what we've seen over the last 10 years is the creeping consolidation of the Turkish media ownership structures in the hands of literally sons-in-law and cousins and so forth and of Erdogan. And so the degree to which, on the one hand, you have a huge spectrum of the Turkish media actually owned directly by AKP-affiliated businesses and in times with ownership shares by AKP-elected officials and the family members of the president and prime minister. And then on the other hand, you have a vast array of weapons that have been deployed against the opposition media, including putting many of the editors, never mind journalists, in jail on terrorism charges, on corruption charges, and so forth. The only, sort of semi-positive thing in this picture is that the simultaneous emergence of a massive and quite independent social media presence in Turkey has meant that it's not been sufficient. The silencing of the opposition media has not been sufficient to fully occlude information from the public sphere, but Turkey has also made itself distinguished for its attempts to censor the internet, close YouTube, stop, block Twitter, block Facebook, and so forth. And, I mean, really, the direction that the government is going in is extraordinarily authoritarian. Now, are elections continuing to be conducted? Absolutely. Does the AKP actually enjoy popularity amongst, you know, as much as 50% of the country? Yes. So what we're seeing is not, you know, an authoritarianism of the kind that might be associated with, let's say North Korea or parts of the Arab world before the uprisings, but rather what we're seeing is a strategy of electoral authoritarianism, maybe more reminiscent of Egypt.
So what can stop Erdogan? I mean, clearly he's butting heads with the U.S. because the U.S. has discovered that the Kurds are their best allies in the fight against the Islamic State, and yet, you know, as the U.S. is now sending boots on the ground to work with the Kurds, Erdogan is sending his F-16 jets in to strafe the Kurdish Syrian fighters. So it would seem to me that, if not publicly, privately, the U.S. is butting heads with Erdogan. And where is this going to lead?
Would that were so. I mean, I have yet to see evidence, either privately or publicly, that the U.S. has actually held Turkey to account for its strategy. I mean, let's not forget that the Turkish participation in aerial strikes and those aerial strikes now targeting almost exclusively Kurdish actors in Syria and Iraq has occurred under cover of the United States coalition and with U.S. legitimation. I mean, it's the United States that invited Turkey to join with airstrikes, and in exchange, the United States was able to station its own positions in on Turkish soil at the NATO bases in Incirlik, Adana area, and so on. So it's essentially a U.S. license that's enabled Turkey to escalate dramatically its offensive and aggression against Kurdish positions in Syria and Iraq, in addition to the incredible aggression that the government has engaged in on Turkish soil against the Kurdish communities of the southeast. So I hope you're right that behind the scenes there's some evidence that the United States is calling on the AKP to sort of pull back from the position it's taken. But just as the United States has not seemed to effectively censure its Gulf allies for their direct support for some of the very groups that the United States is now opposing on the ground in Syria, it doesn't seem very effective in countering Turkey. In any event, it's sort of neither here nor there towards your original question. What is going to ultimately hinder Erdogan is not going to be pressure from the United States, because he's simply not dependent on the relationship with the United States in order to secure the internal support that he has. The internal support he has depends on a very different configuration of things. So the first thing that could stop Erdogan is a fracture within the AKP, and that would be the absolute healthiest and best thing that could happen in Turkish politics, would be a division in that party such that going forward the AKP would face a competitor that was, let's say, what the AKP itself was once thought to be in 2002-2003, which is the, like, liberal, more progressive, let's say, face of pro-Islamist politics in Turkey. If there was a challenge to the AKP from the right within their own coalition, that would put the brakes on Erdogan. An alternative would be for there to be the kind of awareness and consciousness raising that preceded the June 7th election, which caused members of the electorate to behave strategically, vote strategically, in order to block the AKP's project of consolidating their majority. And there is a stake there beyond the regional crisis. The reason that people were so motivated to stop the AKP from securing a majority of 330 seats in parliament was to prevent them from being able to control enough seats to put to a referendum the constitutional changes that Erdogan is seeking to implement, which would generate what he calls a presidentialist system, a supercharged presidency, where power is consolidated centrally in the executive, but specifically in the hands of the president, the office that he now holds, depriving the parliament of those powers and essentially giving the AKP a guaranteed sort of hold on Turkish politics. As he says, I mean, the AKP project themselves in power until 2023, which will be the centenary of the republic. All of their electoral materials since basically 2011 have declared that they intend to continue for at least 12 years uninterrupted in office beyond their first decade. And, that is really the suffocation of Turkish democracy. And so the only thing that can really happen that can block the AKP's continuing consolidation of power is either fracturing from within the party or much more significant mobilization in the Turkish electorate against it.
So just in closing, Aslab Ali, it sounds like the United States doesn't have a lot of leverage over Turkey.
It has leverage over Turkey as a country. It has limited leverage over the AKP specifically as an actor within the country. So it has leverage at the military to military level. It's an important partner. The AKP wants to characterize itself as maintaining relationships with Brussels and Washington, but of course, first of all, it's not entirely dependent on that. And secondly, there, you know, another dimension that we haven't had an opportunity to discuss of the AKP's role at the moment is its manipulation of the refugee crisis with Europe and its securing of these kinds of photo ops with Erdogan meeting with European leaders, most notably and most recently Angela Merkel, and being told, you know, we're going to fast-track aspects of your accession folder if you'll work with us on the refugee crisis. I mean, the degree of cynicism that Erdogan has shown across the board, it just really cannot be overstated.
Well, Asla Bali, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. At Yale Law School, she was a coordinator of the Middle East Legal Forum, and her forthcoming book is Constitutional Design in Religiously Divided Societies. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the strategic incoherence of the Obama administration's Iraq-Syria policy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Postwar Reconstruction Fiasco. He's a former senior advisor and foreign affairs expert to the U.S. Department of State during the administrations of Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And his latest book is The Kurdish Spring, A New Map for the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Phillips.
Thank you, Ian.
And what's your sense of how the elections in Turkey now, where it looks as if the AKP and Erdogan have got the majority they need to have a parliament without a coalition? Obviously, the fact that he's pretty much resumed the war against the Kurds is a big factor, both in terms of the election itself and where we're heading. So we do have, seem to, like we're on a collision course between Turkey and the United States, since the U.S. seems to have finally come to the conclusion that the Kurds are the only people that they can work with in both Iraq and Syria to combat the Islamic State, and yet their ally Turkey seems to be scapegoating the Kurds.
I'm not sure that they will have a majority. You know, the polls are still open in Turkey. I've been in touch with people there today. You know, they're expecting that the Justice and Development Party of President Erdogan is going to get a plurality, and the outcome will look a lot like the hung jury that we had after the elections on June 7. But I think your broader point about the Kurds is critically important. The U.S. has been tactically coordinating in the battlefield with the People's Protection Forces, which is a Kurdish militia. We've been airlifting weapons and providing close air support. Just last week, we dropped 50 tons of ammunition. In response to the announcement that the White House made that we would be deploying special forces to help them, Turkey attacked them and strafed their positions with F-16s on a couple of occasions. And President Erdogan has pronounced that Turkey doesn't need anyone's permission to attack the Syrian Kurds. It puts the U.S. in a very difficult conundrum if we have to choose between Turkey and our best ally in Syria, the Kurdish militia. If our priority is defeating and degrading ISIS, I think Erdogan is in for a surprise, because we'll choose to support the Kurds than to stand by the Turkish authorities.
But doesn't Erdogan have some leverage here with the use of the Incirlik Air Force Base, the NATO base, which is within 60 miles of Syria, And the fact that the U.S. has to fly its planes all the way from the Gulf, where they barely have time to loiter over the target area, is obviously a massive advantage to having Turkey's cooperation in the fight against the Islamic State.
So that's absolutely the case. But keep in mind that, you know, we spent almost a year trying to negotiate use of Incirlik. Meanwhile, we did have air operations in the skies above Iraq and Syria. If Turkey were to pull the plug on that deal, you know, it would really be considered a hostile act by the White House and the Pentagon. I don't think U.S.-Turkish relations have deteriorated to that point. But if he wants to walk back the deal on Incirlik, it would really be a strong signal of non-cooperation.
So is there a way then to bridge this gap between the U.S. wanting to bolster and in effect protect its new Kurdish ally, and Erdogan has effectively resumed war against them, at least the more militant aspects? And of course he's going after the Syrian Kurds who are associated with Öcalan's PKK, which is the stated enemy of Erdogan.
So there's an important legal distinction between the PKK and the PYD, which is the Kurdish party in Syria. The U.S., the EU, and Turkey consider the PKK a terrorist organization. In U.S. law, the PYD, the Syrian Kurds, are not classified as such. Erdogan views them both as terrorist organizations, but in reality, they are distinct. They are operationally separate from one another. They do share a history and an ideology, but that doesn't put the PYD in the same basket as the PKK. And, you know, there's a broader question here, too. You know, we classified the PKK as a terrorist organization in 2001. It was part of a deal where Turkey became the commander of the international force for Afghanistan. There's a discussion going on in Washington about whether the PKK belongs on that list. You know, right now, given their commitment to a ceasefire and their nonviolent pursuit of greater democratic and cultural rights, now there's real question as to whether or not the PKK should stay on the terrorist list.
But just to touch on the whether or not the AKP, Erdogan's party, has won the elections, according to the BBC, with 80% of the votes counted, the AKP has 50.8%, with the main opposition CHP at 23.8%, and the pro-Kurdish HDP and nationalist MHP, they appear likely to cross the 10% threshold needed to claim seats in the parliament. So is that your understanding of where we stand now?
So I haven't seen that report. You know, if the AKP is banking more than 50% of the vote, you know, I would have serious doubts about the credibility of the election. In my view, the only way they get to that supermajority is through electoral fraud. There already have been reports by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe about the conditions for the election not meeting international standards. If the AKP is counting more than 50%, there's going to be an uproar among the voters in Turkey as to whether or not the election was free and fair.
Well, there's already been an uproar because of the bombing of the HDP, the Liberal and Kurdish Party, that were blown up in the 100 people were killed in a peace rally right there in the capital. And it was pretty clear from the victims that they blamed the government for not providing them with security. So it seems pretty clear that Erdogan is treating the left and the Kurds as being sort of less than Turkish. You know, they're the other. Isn't that what's going on? This country's highly polarized, Turkey I'm talking about, and Erdogan is has driven this polarization.
Yeah, he is a deeply divisive and polarizing figure. He has been systematically attacking the Kurds. You know, there were three bombings in Diyarbakir, in Suruç, and most recently in Ankara. You know, the government immediately announced that it was ISIS, but ISIS didn't take responsibility for it. They didn't, which they always do. They didn't release any slick videos through social media. Then there was speculation that the PKK was responsible for it, but most of the victims were actually supporters of the HDP, which is the pro-Kurdish party. So there's a very widespread view in Turkey that the government itself was behind those bombings, and that some apparatus of the deep state, which is under the control of President Erdogan, is actually behind the attacks. It'd be par for the course, given the very hostile approach that Erdogan has taken to the Kurds, and his view that they can win the election by polarizing the country and alienating the more progressive liberal voters.
But once you take that deep breath, what do you do? I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the Turks obviously have some leverage. They not only you have the base there that we talked about at Incirlik, a lot of the refugees have been going through Turkey, and for the longest time it seemed that Turkey was handling the problem on the ground through humanitarian assistance. I think they spent about $5 billion on Syrian refugees. And then more recently, they're just letting them go and cross the Aegean, take that hazardous journey into Europe. And, you know, we know that millions are swarming into Europe and it's causing problems in Europe. So isn't the refugee factor also a big part of it?
So it's true that Turkey has provided sanctuary to many refugees. The estimate is maybe 2 million at a cost since 2011 of 8 billion euros. You know, what Turkey's doing now is they've gone to the EU and they said, you want us to interdict the flow of refugees trying to go to Greece? Now give us 3.5 billion euros, allow visa liberalization so we can travel to EU countries and speed up our candidacy. There's something unseemly about trying to keep refugees in Turkey when they're aspiring to a better life in Northern Europe. Turkey deserves some credit for its handling of the refugee crisis at the outset. I don't think its handling these days has the same integrity.
Well, you're talking about blackmail, aren't you?
So I'm not sure I would use that word. It certainly is rank opportunism. Mm-hmm. It's not becoming for Turks who have a history and culture of hospitality. I understand that Turkey didn't expect the refugee crisis to go on as long as it has, but to try to extort money from the EU in exchange for compliance with the EU's humanitarian action plan just is not becoming of a country like Turkey.
So what is happening then? We know that the situation in Syria sort of blew up in Erdogan's face, that he was very close to the Assads, and then he felt betrayed by the way they behaved in not accommodating their people's aspirations for more freedom. Instead, they turned on them brutally and created this civil war and this destruction of this country to the point where half the population has been displaced and probably 300,000 have died so far. And the country itself is systematically being ruined. And we know that the Turks turned a blind eye to the influx of jihadists to join the Islamic State. And now it seems, I'm not even sure what Erdogan's policy is now. But the fact that the Russians have entered the picture, has that complicated things? Because I think I can't imagine that Turkey's happy with Russia.
So Turkey wanted a no-fly zone over Syria. Now that Russian planes are there, now that they're flying MiGs in Syrian airspace, the idea of a no-fly zone is really a non-starter. You know, when President Obama said Assad must go, Erdogan took him at his word, and the U.S. didn't back its tough talk. It drew a line in the sand, a red line over the use of chemical weapons, and ended up subcontracting its enforcement to the U.N. and to Russia. So beginning in 2012, Turkey didn't turn a blind eye to the transit of jihadis through its territory. It actively promoted the transfer of extremists from Turkey to the battlefield in Syria, provided logistical support, weapons, money. Those who were wounded in the battlefield in Syria would end up in Turkish hospitals without any identification or payment. It wasn't until recently that Turkey realized that ISIS couldn't be controlled and ISIS would eventually turn on them, but the infrastructure for supporting militancy is in place, and I believe it's still going on. So Turkey's put itself in a very difficult position. And it doesn't have much room for compromise. And with Russia now in the battlefield and relations with the U.S. fraying and the U.S. supporting the Kurds in Syria. Now, Turkey is finding itself increasingly isolated, and its future is growing darker and darker.
And if these elections are stolen, you don't think Erdogan's going to get away with it?
I'm not sure that he won't get away with it. I do think that if he gets a supermajority, that doesn't reflect the will of the Turkish electorate. But, you know, Erdogan has shown himself to be a crafty politician. You know, he's a street fighter by nature. And, you know, he'll do whatever it takes to stay in power and to move towards an executive presidency that he can control and consolidate his power. So I think that Turkey's democracy is really at risk. Turkey's reliability as a NATO ally is in question. And the strong U.S.-Turkish relationship, the strategic partnership that's existed for years, is now in serious doubt.
So who does that hurt more, though, the fact that this relationship's in trouble? I mean, again, it just seems that the U.S. is at a logistical disadvantage. In Iraq, it still has to deal with the government in Baghdad that's corrupt and incompetent, and it still has some ambivalence over dealing with the Kurdish state of Iraq, or Iraqi Kurdistan, which is the only functioning part of the country, and the only, and that's where the U.S. has a real ally, which for some reason, I guess they can't properly arm them because of their arrangement with Baghdad. And then has a similar situation with the Syrian Kurds, who are also the only allies that are worth having in that neighborhood, it seems, in terms of taking on the Islamic State. So is there any way that the U.S. can find other allies, or are we stuck in this dysfunctional relationship with Turkey?
The Obama administration has shown an uncanny inability to distinguish its friends from its foes. The fact that it is still adhering to a one Iraq policy, to me, is just confusing. Iraq and Iran and Syria have entered into a security agreement with Russia. When weapons were being flown from Russia through Iraqi airspace to the Latakia air base, the Russian base in Syria, the U.S. sent an envoy on September 5th to tell the government in Baghdad that it shouldn't allow the weapons to be delivered through its territory. And we were just simply ignored. You would think that after spending several $1 trillion, no more than 4,000 Americans killed, tens of thousands maimed, that we would have some greater influence over the government of Iraq. But we still adhere to this flawed and delusional one Iraq policy. The way to remedy that is to recognize that our best and only friends in Iraq are the Kurds. There's a Kurdish adage that says the Kurds have no friend but the mountains. These days, in both Iraq and Syria, the United States has no friend but the Kurds. And we should be providing them with the heavy and offensive weapons they need. We should be giving them the diplomatic support. And instead of standing by Baghdad and standing by Ankara, who are adversarial to our interests, we should be working with those who are friendly to what we want to accomplish.
Well, David Phillips, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Ian, always a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with David Phillips, who's the director of the Peace Building and Rights Program at the Institute for the Study of Human Rights at Columbia University and the author of Losing Iraq Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.